Let's open our Bibles. We'll be in Song of Solomon this evening again. I get interesting comments teaching Song of Solomon. I get comments, people who say, well, I'm not coming until it's over. Let me know when it's done. Not in a bad way. They just don't want to deal with Song of Solomon, I guess. And other folks who say, you know, I've never studied Song of Solomon. They're fascinated by what it says. And at every time I've taught it, afterwards, at least one person, sometimes as many as three people, have come up to me and said, I'm so glad you're teaching this instead of me because of the subject matter. It's so intimate. And yet, on the other hand, you know, we come to church and we sort of keep our distance, at least unless it's really, really crowded, and then we kind of bump into each other a little bit. But in our heart of hearts, we are intimate people. I mean, human beings are created, really. They're created for intimacy. They're created for touch. They're created to be loved. They're created to love. God created us this way. It ought not to be a great surprise that He would put a book into His literature. And the Bible is filled with different kinds of literature. I don't know if you're aware of that, but it ought not to surprise us that He would put a piece of love poetry about physical love into His book. That shouldn't surprise us really at all. I think it's simply a leftover from our somewhat perhaps warped view of physical life that makes us think that God, that it would be beneath Him to write about human intimacy. It certainly is not beneath Him. He created human intimacy. He's delighted with it. He believes it's a good thing. And to the extent that the church has been saddled with the idea that human intimacy is automatically a bad thing, to that extent we have failed to convey the truth of God. We must convey it accurately. We've bent over too far backwards sometimes as Christians because our world is so given over to sensuality and illicit lovemaking. We tend to find ourselves constantly kind of angry about the subject, you know, frustrated over it and angry at our world. And really, you know, God is angry at sin, but He is not angry at the physical nature of humanity. He created the physical nature of humanity. And from the time we are young children, babies, infants, until we die and we go to be with the Lord. And I believe there's going to be some serious touching going on in heaven, by the way. Based on the creation He's made here, I think heaven is a very physical reality. From the time we are tiny infants until the time we die, we never lose the need for emotional and physical intimacy, touching. There's a time and a place, and we've seen that over and over, even in this love poetry. We've seen it, and we've seen the balance. But I read an interesting thing recently that kind of brought this home to me several years ago about little infants and touch. There was a doctor, true story, there was a doctor who was a pediatrician in a large metropolitan hospital, lots of little kids of all ages. And some interns were working with him, and one in particular took a great interest in this doctor and his way with the kids because he noticed that the kids loved this doctor just totally. I mean, they couldn't get enough of this guy, and they would do anything he said. And there was real devotion, more so than to the other doctors. And so this one intern watching this older doctor followed him around on his rounds. And in the process, couldn't figure out what it was, couldn't see that he was doing anything appreciably different than the other doctors until it came to evening time, and he noticed that this doctor kissed every one of the kids goodnight. Isn't that amazing? You don't think of doctors doing that, but it was that consistent behavior. He'd hug him and kiss him goodnight, and those kids just loved him. You see, we never outgrow that. From the time we're little until the time we're old, we need someone to touch us. We need someone to love us. So, God has put a book about that into His book. And the Song of Solomon is, as I've mentioned before, love poetry, written really from the standpoint of a young woman who's madly in love with Solomon. And she is his bride. And we find in this poetry dream sequences, which we'll see another one of this evening. And some of them are happy dreams, erotic dreams, as a matter of fact, where she's imagining her love life with the man that she loves. And others actually have sort of a dark tone to them. We're going to see one of those this evening. We see dream sequences. We see Near Eastern poetry and metaphor, which is sometimes hard for us to deal with because the way they describe each other, the way they speak to each other is far more flowery, and they use different metaphors than we would use. It's almost embarrassing, you know, when we read some of it. But you got to get past that. I've mentioned that twice before. I'll say it every time I teach on it. You got to get past that and feel what they're feeling. Don't get hung up on the wording. Poetry is written emotion. I don't know if you've ever thought of what poetry is. We're a very prosaic people. In other words, as Americans, we're not very poetic, generally. We like prose. Give it to us straight. We want to hear just the bottom line. Poetry is not that way. It's written emotion. It's emotions written down. And this poetry is deeply, profoundly emotional. And because of that, we can bog down in the wording if we don't get past that and say, wait a minute, I want to look for the feeling being conveyed, and I want to connect with that feeling. If you don't do that with the Song of Solomon, you'll get lost in it. You have to get past some of the verbiage that they used, which made a tremendous amount of sense to them and not a whole lot to us sometimes. So it's love poetry from a young woman's standpoint as she speaks of herself and her lover. But there's also a third party or group of people involved. And that's the friends of the bride, they're called by various different scholars. Every once in a while, you'll see an insertion into the text of some poetry from some people who seem to be standing on the sidelines. It's almost as if it's a play, and the scenes change. And if you've ever been to some kinds of plays, there'll be a scene change, and then someone will speak from off stage, and they'll sort of say something which kind of keeps the momentum of the story moving along a little bit. Okay, now watch for that, because you'll see the dream sequences, the thoughts of the young woman, her words to her man, then you'll see his words to her, his description of her as beautiful, and then you'll see sometimes these other folks will say things, and sometimes the characters, especially Shulamite, the woman, she will speak to these other characters off stage. And all of that serves to enhance kind of the mystery of all the poetry, okay? This is not just a story. This is not just prose. This is poetry. So loosen up a little bit. Don't think in such wooden, prosaic ways when you read stuff like Song of Solomon. You really have to kind of mellow out and loosen up if you want to get the feeling for this. And it's you'll also see it's very sensuous. Because we are sensuous people, after all. God created us that way. So we'll begin this evening in chapter 5 and hopefully go to the end of the book this evening. Now, what has happened up to this point in the play, if you will, is that they have courted. She has dreamt of him and he of her. They've spoken to one another lovingly. They have been married. In fact, he sent his entourage to pick her up. In chapter 3, verses 6 to 11, Solomon sends this parade. And I talked about it last time. If it doesn't come across very clearly in the version you're reading, want to pick up the tape from last time. But he's probably sending his coach to get her. He may have actually been there. So here she is being honored as his bride. And then the wedding night, described in chapter 4, down into chapter 5, verse 1. And the consummation of the marriage and all the delights of intimacy. And then at the end of chapter 5 verse 1, you find again from off stage, it says, "Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers." The Hebrew word for lovers, a very rich word. It means far more than sexual partners. It means people who are intimate at every level and who share everything in their lives, which is what lovers are supposed to be. And it's rendered lovers generally in English, but there's so much more to it than just we think of lovers almost entirely as a sexual thing. It's far more than that. Friend, intimate friend is the idea in the deepest, most powerful sense. And it says the people from offstage are encouraging this couple as the consummation of the marriage and the wedding night has gone by and they are in each other's arms and they are in love with each other. And from offstage it says, amen to this. This is a good thing. And then she has a bad dream. This is a dream sequence, and it stretches pretty much down into chapter 6, and what happens is she has a bad dream, she says something to the people off stage in the dream, they say something back to her, and then she describes her husband in the dream, and I'll tell you where it's going. What happens is she has a dream that her husband comes to her and she turns him down. Now, this is an amorous kind of overture he's making. In the dream, he comes to her, and he wants into her bedroom, and she's too tired, and she doesn't want to get up and open the door for him. And what happens is, about the time she says, oh, okay, and she gets up, she gets to the door, and he's gone. And she has this horrible, horrible feeling that now she's lost him. And she looks, and she goes through the streets looking for him in the dream. And it's very much a panic kind of a situation for her. And then she speaks to the people off stage, and they speak to her, and they say, well, who is this that you're after? And so she begins then to describe him in glowing terms, one of the rare places in Scripture where a man is actually described in these kind of glowing terms. Usually it's women, but he's described as this beautiful specimen of manhood, just marvelous man. And so watch for that as we go through it. This is a dream sequence. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew and my locks with the damp of the night. In other words, he snuck through the night in this dream, snuck through the night to come and be with her. She says, I've taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. I don't want to dirty them again. I don't want to get up. My beloved extended his hand through the opening. My feelings were aroused for him, and I arose to open to my beloved. The doors had inside locks. You could reach in and open them. And that's what he was doing. He was saying, come on, I want to get in there. And she sees his hand, and she hears that he wants in, and she changes her mind. And she says, okay, I'm going to get up. Well, it turns out to be too late. She said, go away, don't bother me. I have a headache. And he said, ah, come on. And finally, she says, okay, and he's not there. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and gone. And my heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I didn't find him. I called him, and he didn't answer me. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me, and they struck me and wounded me. What a horrible, horrible thing. Now, in the dream, you know, sometimes when you have dreams and you do something that you feel is wrong, and then something bad happens to you, I wonder, it doesn't say, but I wonder if in her dream she felt really bad for having turned him away, this man that she loves so much. And then in the dream, she gets beaten up by the watchmen of the city. They struck me, they wounded me, the guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. And then she speaks to the daughters of Jerusalem, these people off stage. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. In other words, tell him I want him. Tell him I'm sorry. All this in this dream. Incidentally, all intimacy, physical and emotional, and this is vital for marriage, it's vital for any relationship, really, even a relationship that doesn't have a lot of physical intimacy, a good friendship still has emotional intimacy. And there's a timing in it. There's a timing in it. And everybody who's been married knows the feeling of having bad timing. Everybody who's been married knows the feeling of approaching your spouse, maybe with love on your mind, and it's just the wrong time. Or maybe just wanting to talk, and it's the wrong time. And you go through this thing where you feel like you know those little weights that they put on the wheels of your car? If the weight is in the wrong place, the car just wobbles, and it's like it's just not working right. And relationships do this. And you know what it is? It's bad timing. It's bad timing, and there's nobody that avoids making that mistake. Among all human beings, nobody avoids making that mistake in a long-term relationship. We all blow it. We all say and do the wrong thing at the wrong time, and then try to make up for it and make another mistake, and then try to make up for that, make a deeper mistake, and we just have this terrible feeling. I think men more than women sometimes have this terrible feeling of digging themselves deeper and deeper and deeper, and you say, is there anything I can say to get myself out of this? And she looks at you and says, no, not really. You know, you're stuck. It's bad timing. Bad timing. Give it a rest. Come back and try again. See, and if you don't understand that, then every time anything goes wrong, you're going to panic. You're going to forget that. It's interesting to me that after the glory, really, of last week's look at what happened on the wedding night, the very next thing that she dreams about is bad timing. And she makes this terrible, really, what she feels is a terrible error. She pushes him away and then feels horrible for it and wonders if he still loves her. Well, there's no question she still loves him, but she feels guilty on the inside. Now, the reason we know she still loves him is because she describes him. Because in verse 9, the people off stage say, "What kind of beloved is your beloved? What kind of lover is your lover? Oh, most beautiful among women." This is her dream, remember? I think that's kind of nice that in her dream they call her the most beautiful among women. "And what kind of beloved is your beloved, that thus you would tell us this?" In other words, who is this man, they say to her in the off camera, in the dream. Who is this man that you would tell us to go find him in the streets and tell him that you love him? "Oh, my beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold, and his locks are like clusters of dates, and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk. They repose in their setting. His cheeks are like a bed of balsam, banks of sweet-scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His abdomen is carved ivory." He's got a good six-pack there. You know, he's a guy with some real abs, okay? That's the way we'd put it. "Inlaid with sapphire." Abs with jewels on them. Whoa. "Inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of alabaster set on pedestals of pure gold." You want to keep this in mind when you're working out. "His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." Ah, oh, this is the guy I love. Wow. Was he really that good looking? To her, he was. And you know, honestly, that's all that matters. And that should be all that matters. There should be one person in your life who thinks you're just the coolest. And if that person doesn't think you're the coolest, actually probably the reason they're dating you is because they think you think that, so you had better keep it going. We're naturally drawn to people who seem to be drawn to us. This is a normal, natural human response. It's amazing how much more attractive a person will appear to you once you find out they are attracted to you. It's very interesting how that works. She says, "Oh man, it's this guy. I mean, if you only knew, he's the most wonderful man." Was he really that way? Probably not. But I'll bet it would have been really good for her to go back from time to time and read this poetry after they'd been married for a few years. You know? Because we tend to forget all the good stuff about somebody. We tend to forget it in the grind of daily life. You know, grit gets into the relationship like dirt gets into the oil in a motor. And it grinds it down. It's the little gritty stuff that grinds it down. It's not the big stuff. It's the little gritty stuff over the years grinds it down. And then you forget why you loved them in the first place. So if you've written some poetry or you've even made a list, how very prosaic, a grocery list. But if you got to do it, do it. Sit down someday and just write down all the stuff you really love about the one you love. Anyway, so she says to the daughters of Jerusalem, "Oh man, if you only knew. Well, where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to pasture his flock in the gardens and gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, he who pastures his flock among the lilies." What she's doing at this point, this is a repeat of some of the intimacy language from a previous chapter. And what she's doing is, she's reminding herself, no, he belongs to me. Where did he go? And she's saying, well, I don't think he went too far. I don't think he ran away from me. I think we're still together. And then what happens is he chimes in. Now, whether this is the end of the dream and this is really him speaking, it's hard to tell. And it's hard to tell in Song of Solomon in general. And if you read commentaries and you do scholarly stuff with books of the Bible, Song of Solomon is sometimes difficult. It's difficult to tell where one person stops talking, another person starts, and it's difficult to tell when a dream sequence ends and reality takes over. But I take it that she's awakened and that he's actually speaking to her. And what happens is he reaffirms to her his love for her despite the fact that she had turned him away. "You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me. Now, that's an interesting way to put it. Turn your eyes away from me. Eye contact is an extremely intimate and threatening thing. Have you ever noticed that? Eye contact is an... I can get a person's attention very quickly when I'm teaching by making more than about a two-second eye contact with anybody. You try it. Try it in the crowd sometime. Make eye contact for more than a second or two with anybody. They'll look back at you, then they'll look down, then they'll look back at you to see if you're still looking at them. Then they'll glance away. They'll keep looking back at you. It will become very intimidating. Then they'll look in the mirror and see if there's anything in their teeth. Eye contact is it's very powerful. He says, turn your eyes away. They confuse me. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Gilead. This is very similar to what we saw last week. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from washing. They all bear twins. You're not missing any teeth. I'm going to marry you quick before any fallout. And not one among them has lost her young. That's what that means, no missing teeth. Your temples are like a slice of a pomegranate behind your veil. I don't know. It made a lot of sense to her. And you're better than all the other women. Now that is very important. Verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines, maidens without number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. How important it is for the one you love to know that they are unique in your life. They are unique in your life. The point is not, do you think that, you know, when your spouse asks you how they look, the point is not to say, just fine. You need to say, better than anybody else. You need to say, you're in the top 2% nationally. You need to say, you need to have these kind of comparison things going on, because that's how people think. Now, I don't make that walk on all fours. I know it sounds kind of carnal, but the fact of the matter is we do compare. And what he does here is extremely flattering and very powerful stuff. Because there's one thing Solomon knew about, and that was women, okay, if you know his history. And so when he said, you're better than all the other women, it was really saying something to her, and she needed to know that. We won't go into why he had all those other women, and that's a whole other story, but just learn the lesson here. He says, you're my perfect one. You are unique. Verse 10, who is this that grows like the dawn? He's still speaking of her, I think, here. As beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners. So impressive. You give me goosebumps. I mean, that's the army with banners thing. And the beauty, you walk out, you look at the moon when it's really big, like it has been this year. When on a clear night and you see the moon out there this year in this winter, it's huge and it's impressive. And you just stand out there. You can go out and stand there and look at it and you just stare at it. And he says, that's the way you are to me. Just looking at you, just staring at you. You fascinate me. Everybody wants to be fascinating. Everybody wants to be fascinating. Everybody wants someone to look at them and go, you're fascinating. Solomon knew what he was doing. He wanted to reassure her, and he is doing a real good job of it. Verses 11 and 12. Now, verses 11 and 12 are hard to interpret, but I'm taking them this way. I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of the noble people. There's a question here, and there aren't a whole lot of questions in the poetry. But there's one here, and I think what she is saying is, are we okay? I went down to see if the blossoms were budding. I went down, because this is all language that has to do with love, love that they have experienced already. But now, after turning him away, then he comes back. She's been through this trauma, even in her dream. He comes back, reassures her, no, I do love you. Our timing is off sometimes, but I do love you. And she's now asking him, I went back and checked, are we okay? Is there still a bud on the tree? Is there still a blossom? Are things still clicking? Are we all right? Are we okay? And then the answer is yes. Before I knew it, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. What that means is, it's a reference back to the previous parade, back to the idea that I realized, oh, yeah, I still have that place in your heart, she says to him. Do you ever ask that question, by the way? Do you ever ask the question of your married partner, are we okay? Are you happily married to me? You know, one of the advantages of being involved in people helping, in ministry and counsel and so on, teaching, is that you see so much damage. And often you come back from that in helping people and you will sit down with your own spouse and say, are we okay? Because you can learn, you can just take each other for granted for so long. You can just cruise along and think, you know, nothing's wrong, everything's fine, and not pay attention. Sometimes it's good to ask the tough questions, to really ask point blank, are we okay? Is there anything you would change about me that would make life easier for you and would make life better for you? Have I lost your respect? Because your respect is more important to me than anybody else's respect. And if I've lost yours, then I've lost everything. Because honestly, that's the truth. Whether you're a man or a woman, you lose the respect of your spouse, you got to find a way to get it back. And if it's been lost, your spouse needs to tell you how to get it back, and you got to get it back together. And that actually builds that relationship, you see. She says, do we still have it? And then she finds out that they do. Come back, O Shulamite. This is the off-camera people again. Come back, that we may gaze at you. We want to see this. This is great. Why should you gaze at the Shulamite as at the dance of the two companies? That's actually the Hebrew word Mahanaim, and we named one of our camps after it. It's a reference to two groups of people dancing, two camps. And she says, why are you looking at me like some sort of party? That's what she's saying. Off camera, they're saying, come on, come on. It's like a cheering section for these lovers as they're working through this problem. We want to see this, all right. And the Shulamite answers back, why are you gawking at us? You know, why are you looking at me? And then Solomon picks up and starts to speak to her. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. Your navel, now this is a great one, is like a round goblet, which never lacks mixed wine, and your belly is a heap of wheat. I don't know that I'd use that if I were you. I just don't know, the heap of wheat thing with the belly. But it meant a lot to her. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes like the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. We don't know where that was, but it was beautiful. Your nose. That's a good thing to talk about. At times, your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. I don't know if I'd say that about anybody's nose. And it faces Damascus. It's like... He means you got a proud nose. You know, have you ever noticed how everybody has something about them they don't like? Everybody. You check everybody, and you know, you never noticed it. But you get to know people, you find out there's always some physical thing about themselves they don't like. Now, they don't let on, but there's something. And you get to know them, you marry them, and you find out there's something they've always been embarrassed of. You want a good piece of advice? Make that a particular object of your affection. Because they need to know they're okay with you. Now, maybe she had the biggest nose in the entire country, and it was pointing at Damascus and casting a shadow over Samaria. I don't know. But he found good specific stuff to say, I love this about you. Your head crowns you like Carmel. That's a mountain range in the middle of Israel. And the flowing locks of your head are like purple threads, and the king is captivated by your tresses. How beautiful and how delightful you are, my love, with all your charms. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. And I said, I'm going to climb the palm tree, and I'm going to hold on to the fruit. Oh, boy. May your breasts be like the clusters of the vine. I was talking to my brother about this. I'm teaching Song of Solomon. He quoted this verse to me.
He said, I'm glad you're teaching that, not me. And the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. You think these two are enjoying each other? Yeah, I'd say so. This wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, flowing gently through the lips of those who fall asleep. Isn't that a cool way to put it? I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me, she says. Come, my beloved, let's go out into the country. Let's spend the night in the villages. Let's rise early and go to the vineyards. Let's see whether the vine has budded and the blossoms have opened and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. And there I will give you my love. The mandrakes have given forth fragrance. Over our doors are all the choice fruits, both new and old, which I have saved up for you. Notice, saved up for you, my beloved. I want you to hold that thought, because she comes back to this in the last part of chapter 8. There was some saving in her life that she saved for her groom. And so, you know, making up is, it makes the fight worth it, you know? And that's what happens in chapter 7. Chapter 8. She continues, oh, that you were like a brother to me. Now, what meaneth this? Because that doesn't sound right. Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breast, and I found you outdoors, and I would kiss you, and no one would despise me either. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, who used to instruct me, and I would give you spiced wine to drink from the juice of my pomegranates. Let his left hand be under my head. Let his right hand embrace me. She'd say, oh, man, I wish you were my brother, because then what she's saying is I could show affection to you in public. Now, that doesn't sound like much to us, but in their culture, you never show affection in public, even to this day. Now, in Israel, it's very westernized, and so there's quite a bit of public affection. People hold hands, and they're arm in arm, and they hug each other, and so on, in the Israeli part of the country. But you go to the Arab parts of Israel, you go to Arab nations, they never show any public affection, and they never even touch. Men and women will not even touch. It's considered terribly inappropriate by their cultural standards. In fact, one time when we were there, I think it was several years ago, we were there up in the northern Israel, where there are quite a few Arab settlements, and there were some young Arab girls who were in the same area we were. We were in the Dan Nature Reserve, which is like a big park at the headwaters of the Jordan River, and we had stopped for a Bible study, and one of the guys was teaching, and some of us were standing around, and you know how Americans, married couples, they'll stand arm in arm, or even hold on to each other, they'll hug on to each other, you know. Sometimes the guys will be standing right behind their wife or something, and put his arms around her shoulders and stuff, and so everybody's doing this. Well, these little young Arab girls, they must have been about 15, two or three of them, it's okay for the women to show affection to each other in their culture, but you never have a man show affection to you in public, or vice versa. They came and they were staring at us. They were like, ooh, you know, wow, you know, making faces kind of, you know. And we didn't know what they were doing until afterwards, and the guy explained it to us, that they were from an Islamic background, and they were quite taken with the fact that we would show affection, even that rather mild amount of affection, in public. Well, what she's saying here is, I wish these social restrictions were not on me. She wants to sort of break the bonds socially and say, I wish you were, if you were my brother, I could throw myself on you and you could carry me around. Nobody would think a thing about it. But I can't. I wish I could. And she's just expressing her love for him and her desire for him. And then she says in verse 4, I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until it pleases. Same refrain that we've seen in the past. There's a time and a place. There's a time and a place. There's a time and a place. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Now this may be the other people speaking from off stage again. Now speaking of the couple as they're walking up together, they have been reunited. They have been intimate. They are madly in love with each other. It's a sort of, in fact, in my notes, I call this the afterglow. They're sort of walking along together, coming up out of the wilderness as a loving couple, And the off camera says, who are these people? Beneath the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave you birth. Put me like a seal over your heart. What is happening here is it's not a dream sequence, but it's a statement, and we'll see this more as we move on, sort of a recap of the importance of this love and how almost being predestined is the feeling, destined for one another. And then the permanence and the joy of the love that they feel for each other. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Very interesting way to put it. Love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol, the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire. Jealousy is the opposite side of love. Love is exclusive, and when the exclusiveness is violated, the jealousy erupts like a volcano. And actually, that's okay. That's because something has been violated. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very fire of God, the only time when the Lord's actually mentioned. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, he would be utterly despised. In other words, there's nothing that you can compare with this. So as this couple comes walking out, the camera sort of fades back and the music begins to play. And there's a sense in which this love has the stamp of permanence, sort of the sense of meaning. And don't make fun of our culture too much when it acts as if human love is the end of everything. You know, like love will solve all problems. We know that love doesn't solve all problems, but it sure feels like it's going to when it's going well. You know, when it's going well, it feels like it's going to solve every problem in the world. It feels like there will never be anything that will be able to come between you. Now, you know what, you guys? We love that idea, and that feeling is something that people are willing to give almost anything for. And it's a point of sadness in our culture that we cannot maintain it. The culture continues to try and find it. You see, this that's being described here, this love that's stronger than death and the overflowing power of it and the fact that it can't be stopped, and our love songs talk about it and everything, don't be too down on that, because it's even in the Bible. It's in the Song of Songs. God says human love is that powerful. It really is. And you want to know something? God feels that powerfully because human love comes from Him. He created it. He took one drop out of His ocean, and that's what we'll die for. I want you to remember that. He took one drop out of His ocean, and this kind of poetry comes out of it. We have maybe a few short years if we're lucky with someone we love so much. Maybe far shorter time than that. Just a fleeting moment, just a glimpse of this, and we're willing to die for it. God is an ocean of it. His presence is filled with it, and everyone in His presence that walks with Him is overflowing with this very thing. Now, our world sings about it, and our world can't seem to find it, can't seem to make it work. But that's a point of sadness, not a point of ridicule for us. We need to understand the world wants it desperately, just doesn't know where to find it, doesn't know how to make it work. These are some of the best love lyrics ever written in the whole world. In fact, probably the best. These two verses, verses 6 and 7. Fabulous. Now, there's a recap of her life from off camera. A description of this woman who has saved herself. And what this poetry is about in verses 8, 9, and 10 is saving her body for the man that she would marry. Remember, I told you to hold on to the idea in verse 13 of chapter 7, being saved up. Verse 8. We have a little sister. She has no breasts. In other words, she's pre-puberty. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? They would betroth their daughters prior to or right at puberty. Okay? And what should we do? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. If she is a door, we will barricade her with planks of cedar. What they're saying is the best service we can do is to keep her pure. That's what they're getting at. And she says, I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers, and I became in his eyes as one who finds. peace. And she said, I did keep it together, and I did not give myself away. Let me give you a piece of straight advice that you can see coming a mile away from this passage. You know, if you're a young person and you're thinking to yourself, the way to wisdom is to get sexually active, think again. Think again. There's no great mystery to sex. Ask anybody who's been married any length of time. They'll tell you. It doesn't work half the time. And there's just no great mystery to it. It's only mysterious to people who are too young to understand it. So take the advice of the people who understand it and keep yourself for the person you're going to marry. Because if you violate that marriage vow even before you even know the person, you're going to be sorry someday. That's a guarantee. If you've already violated it, or maybe you're in the process right now, you're in a situation in which this is actually a point of violation for you. You're not keeping yourself. Repent. Stop now. Let God forgive you. Bring about a change in your life and start over again with Him. But if you have not already made bad decisions, you're even in a better position. Don't make those bad decisions. She basically says, and this is the most sensuous book in the Bible, and at the end of it she says, I kept myself for the man I was to marry, for the man I would love, and I'm really glad. And that is a great, great piece of wisdom. Verse 11, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. My very own vineyard is at my disposal. 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 are for those who take care of its fruit. O you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Here's the voice. Hurry, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. In other words, the enjoyment of the romance and the guarding of the romance, the exclusiveness of the romance. And so it ends with poetry repeated from earlier in the book. Interesting book, isn't it? Interesting poetry, an interesting reminder. I'm going to offer four pieces of advice, which I will pretty much guarantee you will help your relationship if you're married. And even if you're not married, even in normal interaction with people lacking the physical intimacy that is often a part, or has to be a part of marriage, if you have normal relationships and good friendships, some of these things will even affect those. So let me mention these four. First is this, be watchful with care. Be watchful with care. In other words, keep an eye on this, on the texture of the friendship, on the texture of the relationship. You will notice that early on in what we looked at this evening in the dream sequence where she had a bad dream, she was extremely sensitive and fearful that he was going to leave her. You know, there's some wisdom in a little bit of fear that both parties ought to have from time to time. You need to actually sort of stay on your toes. One of the problems with getting married is that you stop paying attention to the relationship. You relax so much that you think, oh, well, you know, we're married now. We don't have to, you know, worry about how we look, how we smell, how we react to each other. If we're dating, my goodness gracious, you know, you make sure everything's just perfect all the time. Now, you can't hold your stomach in forever. You know that. But folks, after being married for a while, a lot of times just the relaxation that we enjoy with each other can become a taking for granted of the other person. And then when we get even the slightest frown from the one we love, we get really angry. When in reality, it could be that we've been slipping a lot, not paying attention, not taking care. And I have counseled more people than I can shake a stick at, and I've shaken a stick at a few of them, who didn't find out until too late that their relationship was rotting from the inside because they didn't pay any attention to it. They just figured everything was fine. And honestly, usually it's men. More often, women see the problems in a relationship before men do. Usually it's the guys who are, you know, they're just busy. They're busy. They're thinking about other things. They've delegated a certain portion of their life to their wife, and they're not really paying attention to whether they're getting along with her. And they haven't asked the tough question, are you happy being married to me? If I were a car, would you trade me in? That's a great question to ask. And if she takes more than, you know, 2 seconds to answer it, you had better check the maintenance record. Listen, if guys took half as good a care of their wives and their relationship with their wives as they do of most of their cars, now there are exceptions to this, I understand, but things would be a lot better. Or even took some cues from their wives. And the same is true for women, too. A lot of times, women do not try and think about their impact on the man, because a lot of times he seems like a guy who can't be moved anyway. And so they figure, well, it doesn't matter what they may say or do, and they may be hurting him desperately, constantly, and they don't even know it. You can drive a car, any car, for 300,000-500,000 miles. You say, no, you can't. Yes, you can. You just have to be willing to make the repairs. If you're willing to make the repairs, you can drive any car any length of time. Well, the reason we say we can't drive that car anymore and we need to trade it in is not because it won't run, it's because we don't want to repair it. And we want a new one. And a lot of people treat relationships that way. But they can be maintained. So the first maintenance tip, be watchful with care. Pay attention, ask the tough question, be prepared for the tough answer. Better to get it now. Better to get a tough answer to a tough question now and work on it than to wait until it's too late. Here's a second piece of advice. Be patient with failure. Be patient with failure. Here, she pushes him away. She's afraid he's not going to love her anymore. He comes back and says, no, I love you. I love you. Now, it's true. They're sort of still on the honeymoon, and you do an awful lot of loving on the honeymoon, you know, and everything's fine, and nobody's got... It's, you know, after the honeymoon's over, and life is kind of really daily, and the grit of it all just kind of gets under your skin. That's when you have to actually do this. Be patient with failure. Because your spouse's failures are numerous, and you know more of them than anybody else, and they're bugging you. They're bugging you. I know a couple who, that's their phrase to each other. When anything goes a little, they say, you're bugging me. You're bugging me. And it's kind of a little comical thing, but it lets off some steam and it gets a piece of communication across. There needs to be the ability to flex with your spouse's failures because they're going to fail all the time. What happens, however, is that as years go by, we become less tolerant, not more tolerant, with failures. We're far more tolerant with the failures of a person we don't know hardly at all, which is why they like us. Really? Why do you want to go spend time with so-and-so? You've only known him, you know, a year, and we've been married 20 years. Well, let's think this through. Maybe it's because so-and-so is just really tolerant. Maybe they just don't harp on you. Be tolerant with failures. I'm not saying never talk about it. I'm not talking about unrepentant sin. I'm not talking about that. I'm not even talking about forgiveness, which is a whole nother thing we could talk about, but it isn't in Solomon, the Song of Solomon. So I'm not dealing with that. I am talking about just plain wobble room, just plain being able to say, well, that really bugs me, but I don't care. That just bugs me. She always does that. That bugs me. But I don't care because I love her. Or he bugs me about that. You know, he does that. That's one of his things. But I don't care. I love him. Say that out loud. I don't care. I love him. Say it again. I don't care. I love them. See? Now, practice this from time to time. It's a good thing to remind yourself of. I don't care because I love him. Remember, we're married and in love. There was a couple I counseled some years ago who turned to one another, and the woman said to the man exactly those words. They're having a fight in my office, which is a unique experience for those of you who would like to be involved in that. And she turned to him in the middle of the thing, and she said, remember, we're married and we're in love. And I thought, that's really great. That is a great thing to be reminded of. And I've told lots of couples that since then. Say it out loud, and it's good for you. Be patient with failure. I don't care. I love them. Here's the third one. Be generous with praise. I guarantee you, if you are generous with praise, which also wears out through the years, you get tired of praising your spouse. You do. But I guarantee you, your spouse never gets tired of hearing it. You just get tired of saying it. So find new creative ways. Take a tip from Solomon. She's got a big nose. Talk about Damascus. I don't know. No, don't do that. But find something specific about your spouse that you really like, make it a point to say, you know what I like about you? This. I really like that. But don't do it in a plastic way. Wait until it's just the right time. Wait until something has happened and you really feel it and you sense it, and then say it. Say it out loud to them. Be lavish with your praise to the people you love and that you want to love you back. We tend to, you know, it's like we're really uptight sometimes. So, well, I don't want to spoil them. I don't want it to go to their head. Let it go to their head. It'll be good for you. It'll be good for them. It'll be good for the relationship. When was the last time you actually said to the person you're committed to more than anyone else in your life what you specifically liked about them and really elaborated on it and said it? Two or three things. This is great poetry here. Find two or three things you like about them. It'll be hard to have a fight after that. It'll be hard for them to have a fight after that. Be generous with praise, and here's the fourth one. Be lavish with affection. And I mean, in case you missed the point, get physical. If you're married and you don't have a good sex life, fix it. Now, there are reasons why sometimes sex doesn't work among married couples. There are problems that arise, and sometimes they can't be fixed, and can't be fixed easily. But barring those situations, if you're a married person, did you know the Bible actually commands you to have an ongoing sex life? 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. You guys are afraid to write that down. I can tell you're just not, you think if you're seen writing that down. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, the Apostle Paul says, it's good not to be involved in immorality. But he, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but he says, some of you are just too spiritual for the Lord himself. No kidding. He says, because some of you married couples are not having an ongoing physical relationship. And he says, stop that and get back to business on that subject, because Satan will tempt you and it will be terrible for you. So he says, if you want to fast from a sex life for a little while as a married couple for the purpose of prayer, he says, fine, but don't make it permanent. Did you know that God commanded that? That's an amazing verse. Some of you are going to memorize that verse. That's going to be your life verse. They're going to say, what's your life verse? It reminds me of Alan Peterson. He wrote a book years ago, back in the late 70s or early 80s, which I'm not sure is in print. It's called The Myth of the Greener Grass, How to Affair-Proof Your Marriage. Terrific little book, which, if it's out of print, I'm sad about that. He tells a story about a middle-aged couple who were held up at gunpoint. And the guy said, up against the wall, it's this couple, you know, they've been married for years. Man, they're scared to death. And he frisks them both, takes his wallet, takes the guy's wallet, watch, rings, all of her jewelry, her purse. And he says, okay, have you got anything else? And she says, no, but if you'll frisk me again, I'll write you a check. Listen. Some, he said that. It's coming to you slowly. Now, some of you guys just got that. You weren't listening. We old married couples need to get our act together. I'm really committed to this already anyway, so I'm stuck with it. I might as well just go ahead and say everything I'm going to say, because if I'm going to get mail, I might as well get it all at once. I'm amazed at the number of married couples who will sleep together, but they won't talk about it. They won't discuss it. They won't ask themselves, how are we doing in this area? Let me encourage you to do that. It's perfectly godly. It's good for your relationship. And you need to ask those questions. You need to find out. Song of Solomon is a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book about intimacy. And it's got great advice for us about how to keep our relationships, our married relationships, vibrant and strong. So remember those four things. Be watchful with care. Pay attention to the texture of the relationship. Be patient with failure. Be generous with praise. Be lavish with affection. Let the love in your life, behind closed doors, really be a good one. And you'd be amazed how pleased God is with that. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you so much for speaking to us in your word about such things. We often Lord, have questions, even arguments about these kinds of things. And yet we're afraid to bring them up, even with you. We don't even want to pray about it. We don't even want to talk to you about it. So we thank you that you open the subject. We thank you, Father, for the attraction that men and women feel toward one another. We thank you for the bonds of marriage that enable us to have emotional and physical intimacy. We know, Lord, that these are areas of our lives so powerful that the enemy wants to turn them against us, and our culture misuses them all the time. But, Father, we know we still need to move in this direction. We need to do it right. So give us wisdom, and I pray for everybody within the sound of my voice that they'd be thinking about the most important relationships in their lives, and those who are married and listening to what I'm saying would be thinking about the one they love, their husband, their wife. And Father, I pray that your Spirit would speak wisdom to them. For those, Lord, among us who have been the victims of devastating marital circumstances in which listening to these Bible studies is difficult, we pray, Father, for your grace and your strength, for a sense of courage and wisdom. Lord, we pray for your hand on all of us as we seek to press through a fallen world, dealing with it in redemptive ways, living wisely along these lines. We thank you and we praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.